Live sport. This is The Grill, exclusively on Dubai Eye 103.8, where we, you, and the world of sport gets to have a say.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to the show. We are live down here at Barasti, 3 until 6 every single Saturday. And what a show we've got for you over the course of the next 3 hours. An awful lot of live sport to keep you up to date with. We've got the cricket, day 4 of the first test between Sri Lanka and India over in Galle. It's also day 3 of the third test over at the Oval between England and South Africa. Updates throughout Formula 1. It's the Hungarian Grand Prix qualifying coming your way. It's the final race before the boys and the teams head off on their summer holidays. Super Rugby semi-final weekend. We've got one result for you, one result to come. I can tell you, good news if you're a Crusaders fan. We'll have all the updates on that. Mark Archer shaking his fist. Clearly, he's a Crusader fan, being a proud Kiwi. Of course, UFC 214. We are building up to that one. Anaheim, California is the host venue. It is Daniel Cormier versus John Jones 2. No love lost between those two. We'll be building up to that one. Football, there's a glut of pre-season friendlies, including Chelsea versus Inter Milan. That one kicking off in just over half an hour's time. Goal updates as they go in. Golf, Porsche, European Open and the Canadian Open. And if all of that wasn't enough, we've got Mayweather-McGregor to discuss as well. Carl Frampton, he won't be fighting tonight. We're going to tell you why in the next hour as well. You're listening to The Grill live at Barasti.
This is The Grill. Get in touch via text on 4001 or tweet us at Dubai Eye Sport.
I did tell you there was an awful lot to get through between now and 6 o'clock. It is your Saturday afternoon. This is the station to stick upon if you do want to know all of your live sports and get all your updates on whatever sport it is you're following. Let me introduce you then to the panel, my guests, my analysts this afternoon. It is the dream team in attendance. Let's start with a big Safa. Carl Van Roosevelt. A very good afternoon to you, my friend.
Very good afternoon, Chris McCarty, and good to be down here at Barasti once again. And what I can tell you is, once again, an action-packed show this afternoon. We'll be focusing on the Formula One. One update I can give you is that Felipe Massa has, what should I say, reported in ill. He has been replaced by Scott Paul de Resta for the Williams team this afternoon. Of course, qualifying will start in about 2 hours' time. And will Lewis Hamilton equal Michael Schumacher's record of 68th pole position? And then, of course, the other big one we'll be speaking about this afternoon, the next Super Rugby semi-final. The Lions take on the Hurricanes down in Johannesburg this afternoon. And can the Lions make their first Super Rugby final? Of course, waiting for them in that final will be the Crusaders. They beat the Chiefs this morning, 27 points to 13. A convincing victory for the boys from New Zealand.
Yes, indeed. We will keep you bang up to date with all of the Super Rugby. That second semi-final between the Lions and the Hurricanes. It all kicks off UE time in about an hour and a half, 4:30 here in the UAE. So that's Carl Van Roosevelt alongside us this afternoon. The next man that makes up the triumvirate, it's Mark Archer, everyone's favourite Kiwi. Mark Archer, very good afternoon.
Afternoon, Christopher. Good to see you, Carlos. And I'll bring you bang up to date with some live international cricket. Two test matches are taking place. Well, one test match is now taking place because we do have a result from Colombo in the first test match between India, of course, taking on their host Sri Lanka. And it's a big, big win to the Indian team. They've won by 304 runs. Sri Lanka have just been dismissed in their second innings for 245. The Indian spinners doing the damage. Jadeja with 3 for 71. Ravi Ashwin with 3 for 65. So India have won the first test match against Sri Lanka in Colombo by 304 runs. The other news is coming through on the third test match at the Oval, day 3. I can tell you that South Africa have avoided the follow-on. They're currently 169 for 9. Themba Bamvula is 52 not out, doing a great job for the Proteas. And Vernon Philander, who has been ill yesterday, he was in hospital, has got out of hospital. He's coming, he's 4 not out. But they are currently way behind England at the moment. They trail England by 184 runs at the Oval. The test match series is tied 1 apiece, but England are firmly in control after 2 days' play of the third test match.
Indeed. Let us start there, if we can, gentlemen. I know you won't thank me for that, Carl. Being a proud South African, of course, it's not been a happy couple of days for the Proteas out there, or over there, should I say, at the Oval. A quick word on Toby Rowland-Jones, if we can, because what a debut for he yesterday. 4 wickets. He was the scourge of the top order of that South African batting lineup. As far as debuts go, that has got to be right up there as one of the most impressive.
Yeah, England actually had three debutants playing in this test match for various reasons. The Essex batsman, Tom Wesley, made his debut. Another South African convert, Dawid Malan, a Middlesex player, made his batting
another
debut.
Another South African.
Well, he is. He's Dawid Malan, a very South African name there, Carlos.
Yeah, joining Jennings at the top of the batting order for England. Yeah.
And the very English named Tobias Rowland-Jones has come in and made a big debut. The Middlesex seam bowler, opening bowler, came in and has made an immediate impact. He had 4 for 22, I think, at one stage yesterday. Almost took the four first South African wickets. And he's very much one of those old-fashioned English bowlers. His mentor's Angus Fraser. He comes in, he hits the pitch. He's not express pace, but he just gets the ball moving off the seam. And conditions overhead and on the pitch were very conducive for seam bowling. Very English-style conditions. And he really exploited them and coming up with a couple of cracking deliveries. One great delivery to get rid of Hashim Amla that bounced off a length. Hashim Amla had the finest glove through to Johnny Bairstow, who took the catch. And a great debut for Tobias Rowland-Jones.
When you say he comes in, he really does come in for an absolute country mile. He's beyond the pavilion, his run in every single time, but he was certainly the scourge of your boys yesterday. Carl, were you impressed with what you saw?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess he must be quite a fit man with that long run-up, to be perfectly honest. But I think, you know, Chris, as good as what he was, I feel the South Africans were very, very poor. And most probably, I think Vilander saw this coming. He went to go spend the day in hospital. He didn't even want to watch what was happening. And I think that the South Africans really need to take a little bit more responsibility, especially at the top of the batting order. They just weren't up to scratch. Yes, this youngster, as Mark says, did move the ball nicely, which they didn't seem to adjust to the conditions. But I expected one guy to come in there, at least stand and take a bit of control, which never ever happened for the South Africans. And that's why they're in deep, deep trouble as we're speaking.
So what a debut it was for Toby Rowland-Jones. It got us thinking this afternoon, memorable debuts. Who can lay claim to arguably the best debut of all time? That is one of the questions we're posing to you guys this afternoon out there on the roads. 4-0-0-1 for your suggestions. I sprung this one on the boys literally about 7.5 minutes ago. Any names? And I'm not just talking cricket either, by the way. It can be all sports. Individuals, both men and women in the sporting fields, who have come to the fore and performed, I guess, better than expectations on their first foray into their discipline.
I can think of the South African rugby player Stefan Sablanch, scored 4 tries on debut.
Wow.
Wasn't against a recognised opposition, but I think he actually still holds the record for most tries scored on debut. Of course, Keegan Bradley in his rookie season, not his first tournament, his rookie season, he won a major, the 2011 PGA Championship. That's just off the top of my head.
I'll stay with rugby. Good friend of the show, Jeremy Guscott, the Prince of Centres. On his debut for England, they were playing Romania, so I'll give him credit where credit's due here, but he scored a hat-trick of tries. He also scored a try on his British and Irish Lions debut, so well played, Jerry Guscott, obviously a man for the big occasion on debut.
And speaking about South Africans playing for England, Jennings, is it Kirtland Jennings? I believe he scored 100 on his debut for England in India a little bit earlier this year or last year, so fantastic debut there by the young South African convert.
Correct me if I'm wrong on this. Did Tiger Woods win the Masters in his first appearance at the Masters? I'll double check that.
I don't think so, because I think he would have made appearances when he was an amateur.
Amateur. Yeah, you're right. So it would have been his first performance as a professional at Augusta.
I think so.
Let me double check that. I just threw that. That was one that just popped in my head there.
I know his first Masters win was in 97. He turned professional, I think, in 96. I'm not sure whether he played it as a professional.
Yeah, he turned professional at the end of the summer in 1996. So
it
by
was
very
his
nature,
first Masters, yes. So
his first Masters.
Tiger Woods, there
and
you
he,
go.
And he won it by then, what was a tournament record 12 stroke on his Masters professional debut. I mean, that is just quite remarkable. Another one that springs to mind, and regular listeners will know, they'll be like, oh, Chris, standard. But Wayne Rooney, Manchester United debut against Fenerbahce, a hat-trick.
Of course, but I think Jordan Spieth might be in the same boat, because he won his first PGA, which was the John Deere Classic, in 2014, if memory serves me correct. And his first Masters he won in 2015, didn't he? I'll double check on that too, but I think he might be in the same boat as Tiger.
Here's one for you. Famous British middle distance runner, Paula Radcliffe. Her first marathon, because we saw her compete in many Olympics and do very well. I think at 10,000 metres was her race limit. Her first marathon distance was a London marathon. She won it. It was the fastest ever London marathon time. 2 hours, 18 minutes, 55 seconds. She wasn't happy because she wanted to set the world record, but Paula Radcliffe there on debut in the marathon. Big win there at the London Marathon.
Keep your suggestions coming in. Dream debuts, that is one of a little fun talking point that we'll discuss over the course of the next 3 hours. Your suggestions would be welcome, as I always say. It is as much your show as it is ours, so get your suggestions in to us on 4001. It is a busy afternoon of sport, as you would expect. It is a Saturday afternoon. I was just remarking to the boys before we came on air, I cannot wait. I'm like a kid at Christmas. I cannot wait for the new football season to kick off. A week on, in fact, 2 weeks today. It is, yeah, 12th of August, 2 weeks today.
Community Shield.
Well, Community Shield is next Sunday. That's the curtain raiser. And then 2 weeks today, the new football season, the new English Premier League football season will be underway.
Does the Championship get away a week earlier, or they start on the same weekend?
I'll need to double check that. I think it may. Yeah, you're right. I think next Saturday is when the Championship gets underway. Then comes the Community Shield, which is the curtain raiser for the English Premier League season. The teams will then kind of go into camp. I say go into camp. They've already been in camp, for goodness sake. But then they'll get, you know, put their heads down for the week and ensure that they are primed, 100% ready to kick off the new season on August the 12th.
Still a lot of speculation of who's going who and who will play who, Chris McCarty. My big question to you is, Alexis Sanchez, is he really ill?
Oh,
a very, very little sorrowful photo he tweeted with his dog sitting next to him.
Yeah, 2 days before he's due back at Arsenal's Cobham training. It's not Cobham, sorry, Arsenal's training ground. I'm thinking Chelsea. Back at Arsenal's training ground, and he posts that he's ill. He's posted a little picture with his pooch, saying that he's down in the dumps, he's feeling under the weather. I think that is Alexis Sanchez. I think that the fun and games are just beginning with regards to Alexis Sanchez. I think he has his heart set, certainly on an Emirates Stadium exit, an Arsenal exit. Whether he's got his heart set on a move to Manchester City or PSG remains to be seen. I'd hazard a guess and say he probably does want to link up with Manchester City. I think he'd be a wonderful addition. But then we've already discussed that on numerous shows, that when you look at City's options from an attacking sense, I mean, take your pick, they've got nine. Add, yeah, Sanchez into the mix, you've got Jesus, Aguero, Sane, De Bruyne, the two Silvas, Sterling.
You've got to ask a question about Pep Guardiola. Surely he's looking at two different squads this season, one for the Champions League, which, of course, is a trophy that City so badly want to win, especially the owners. And then, of course, the Premier League team boost. It seems last season he got caught a little bit short, especially when he was suffering with one or two injuries. You know, Kevin De Bruyne, when he was injured, he seemed to be struggling to fulfill that role. So I think Pep, clearly, for this season, he's going in with two different squads.
I think you're right. I think he was caught cold last season. I think he was getting up to speed himself with the Premier League, getting acquainted with all of its nuances, its quirks, etc. And I think he's definitely learnt one or two lessons from last year. Defensively, I know he's spoken in the last 24 hours to say that he would still like to dip into the transfer market for a centre-half. I think that is an area that could well be doing with strengthening. But from an attacking point of view, I don't think there's a team in the Premier League that can quite match what Manchester City have currently got at their disposal, and what a scary prospect it is if they do go on to add Alexis Sanchez.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we were speaking about it on Sports Tonight in the week. They will definitely be a factor coming in this Premier League, and they will definitely be challenging for the title. But Chris, a lot of speculation currently in the transfer market as the seasons are about to start. To me, the big one currently is what will be happening with Neymar, where will he be going, and if he does make that move, it seems to be a bit of a dominoes effect onto what's going to happen in the rest of the clubs.
Yeah, we spoke about this on Thursday evening Sports Tonight. To me, there's been an awful lot, of course there has, there's been an awful lot of money spent already. Romelu Lukaku's of this world, the Alvaro Morata's, we've seen what AC Milan have done, but I still get the distinct impression that there still needs to be a monumental, a huge transfer that is going to, I guess, kick, a chain reaction of other deals that will happen, that will go through for huge money. You mentioned Neymar. I think Kylian Mbappe would be included in that. Alexis Sanchez. I still think Virgil van Dijk will end up ultimately at Liverpool, but he's still got to go on the move. So there's still an awful lot of teams looking for players and an awful lot of money still burning a hole in their pocket.
And I still believe a move that we might see is Coutinho to Barcelona. If you are a Liverpool fan out there, text us in on 4001 and let us know what you think of Coutinho moving to Barcelona. Will it happen or will it not happen this season?
Yeah, keep your thoughts coming in on 4001 very, very quickly. Mark Archer, South Africa's pain, well, they've been put out of their misery.
Yeah, South African have been dismissed on day three for 175. The last man to go was Themba Bamvula for 52. And we're talking about successful debutants in sport. And Toby Rowland-Jones has taken 5 wickets in his first innings as an England seam bowler. He's taken 5 for 57. That goes with his 25 hard-hit runs in the England batting lineup. So what that means, Chris, England in their first innings, 353. South Africa have now been dismissed for 175. It's a big, big lead. for England as they will start their second innings in about 10 minutes' time against South Africa. So England firmly in control of the third test early on day three at the Oval.
Updates throughout from over there at the Oval. A lot of texts coming in this afternoon already. That is good to see. One of the questions we're asking, greatest debuts in sport. A lot of you having your say on this subject. We'll come to your text when we come back.
It's a homecoming. The Grill is back at Barasti, the best bar to watch sport live every Saturday afternoon from Barasti.
It's the opening pre-season friendly of the afternoon. That one kicks off in 15 minutes' time. We'll give you team news in the next 5 to 10 minutes or so. I can tell you both teams naming very, very strong lineups. Still no Antonio Rudiger for Chelsea. He is left on the bench by Antonio Conte. What I can tell you, though, is for fans of Italian football, for fans of Inter Milan and perhaps fans of Chelsea and Manchester United, both Ivan Perisic strongly linked with a move to Old Trafford. He starts for Inter, as does Antonio Candreva, a man that has been linked with a move to Chelsea. Updates on that one throughout. There are a raft of pre-season friendlies to get you up to date with that kick off after we come off air, but we will give you updates on what we're reading, what we're hearing ahead of those fixtures. A lot of texts coming in on dream debuts. That was after Toby Rowland-Jones. 4 wickets yesterday. He's added another one today. And on debut, Mark Archer, he's got a fiver.
He's got a Michelle Pfeiffer, Chris McCarty. He's taken 5 for 57 on debut. Toby Rowland-Jones. South Africa have just been dismissed in their first innings for 175. That means England will take a massive lead of 193 into their second innings. Alistair Cook and that man Jennings will come out to bat shortly. But speaking of Toby Rowland-Jones, this is what he had to say after his 4 wickets yesterday on debut.
It's a great day. I mean, wait a long time to play Test cricket and the first day you spend with your feet up. So, yeah, nice to get in the thick of it today and sort of, I think, a few runs with the bat sort of eased me in a little bit and, yeah, just enjoyed myself out there and ran in, hopefully, as free as possible.
With the batting, though, you came down the stairs nervous?
I think everyone's a little bit nervous and anxious before that first ball, and it helps having someone like Stokesy at the other end and, you know, trying to guide him to as big a score as possible. So, enjoyed batting with him.
What were your plans with the ball then when you started? Deep breaths at the top of your run-up and just make sure you hit the length?
Yeah, I think trying to keep things pretty simple. I think, you know, with the overheads as they were, we felt like if we tried to commit to a slightly fuller length and make them play as regularly as possible, that we were going to be a threat. So, fortunately, that was the way it went.
First test wicket you got, you looked like you didn't realise he'd nicked it.
No, I didn't, yeah. I don't really know what it was, but yeah, I didn't hear anything. So, fortunately, the umpire did.
Tell us about the Hashim Amla ball, because that was a ripper.
Yeah, it was, you know, ironically enough, probably a little bit shorter than what I'm trying to bowl, but that one just seemed to find a bit of live grass and kick up. So, yeah, absolutely enjoyed that one.
Tell us about the conditions. Were the lights making the difference on the pitch, or was there still plenty of action in this surface?
I think the guys batting always said that there were some good balls in there. I think we sort of got through some pretty sticky periods at times throughout the 2 days, and the guys dug in. So, yeah, credit to them, and hopefully we can continue to make the most of those conditions.
Pestering Joe tomorrow morning to let you have a crack to get that fiver?
Absolutely not, no. First game in, I think I'll leave that to him.
Well, he did eventually end up with that fiver. 5 for 57. What a debut for Toby Rowland-Jones. And we were just talking off-air there, Mark Archer. You called him earlier on, Carl, a young man. And I'm not for 1 second saying that 29 years of age is not a young man. But in, I guess, cricketing parlance, he's quite old to be making your debut.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get his stats up, but I believe he's a 29-year-old.
So. Yeah, he is.
He's been around the county scene for a while, of course. He's 29 years old, and he's been part of the very successful Middlesex team. They won the county championship last year, so he's taken a lot of wickets at county level. He's just kind of not been able to force himself into the England setup. He's always been like the next cab off the rank. You know, you've got Stuart Broad there, Jimmy Anderson, who've been a pretty formidable partnership. Ben Stokes comes in the all-rounders role, so he's always been the next guy there or thereabouts, but he hasn't had many opportunities. So it's fair to say he has grabbed his opportunity with both hands. 5 for 57 on debut. He chipped in with 25 valuable runs when he batted at number 9 for England as well. So a fantastic debut so far for Toby Rowland-Jones. It's a shame he's not playing at Lords, because of course taking 5 for at Lords, you get your name up on the honours board there, and that's there for the for a long, long time, up with some of the greats of the game. So yeah, well done to Toby Rowland-Jones. Just an update there. South Africa been dismissed for 175. It's a big lead on the first innings to England of 193. The other result also coming in Test cricket today, India have beaten Sri Lanka by 304 runs. Sri Lanka dismissed in their second innings for 245. The Indian spinners doing the job there. Jadeja with 3 for 71. Ravi Ashwin with 3 for 65. India go 1-0 up in that test series. So the result concluded in Colombo, and England will come out to bat shortly on day 3 at the Oval.
We are talking special sporting debuts. The text lines are lighting up. Let me get to a couple for you. One, no name on this one. 227 says Austin Matthews, Toronto Maple Leafs, 4 goals in the first game. And of course, that is worth pointing out. Austin Matthews came in with a huge reputation. He was the first round draft pick. 4 goals on debut. I mean, we were talking about Wayne Rooney's hat-trick for Manchester United. We talk about, I think, Alan Shearer. Didn't he make or score a debut for Southampton, if memory serves me correct, in his first full debut for the Saints? But to score 4, you've got to live up to expectations from there on in.
Yeah, massive achievement there. Just staying with American sport, LeBron James, obviously one of the best basketballer probably in the last decade, but he made his debut in 2007, and he was one of the last kids, I guess, to say they came out of high school, didn't go to the college system game, was drafted straight out of high school, of course, was the first pick for the Cleveland Cavaliers, and he made his debut, scored 25 points in a 106-92 loss to Sacramento. So see, also, I think Carlos came up with earlier, Allen Iverson, a high school prodigy, was drafted. He scored, I think, 30 points, on debut. I think he might have done 1 year at university, 1 year at college, potentially. But some big-name American sportsmen there. Austin Matthews in ice hockey in the NHL. And then, of course, LeBron James and Allen Iverson making their NBA debuts.
We talk about, well, we don't, we are going to now, LeBron James making the step up to NBA from high school. It is rare. Have we seen anyone do so since LeBron in 2007?
No, because they changed the rule. They said that you had to go
at least one collegiate year.
Yeah, do one collegiate year. So we saw the likes of a lot of guys now go and do one and done. They go and do 1 year. I guess a good example,
Anthony Davis did it.
Yeah, a good example is Kevin Durant as well. Went to 1 year at University of Texas. He was the top player. I think he went in as number 2 in that year's draft. I can't remember who went ahead of him. But then guys now go do 1 year. But they're still readdressing that rule. So it used to be you could go straight from high school. And then we saw in the older eras, we saw players like Michael Jordan do 3, if not 4 years, or a couple of years, maybe 2 years at college level, and then go on and play in the pro game. So I guess it varies, but I think the NBA tried to make sure that the players who came into the NBA had a bit more life experience. They're a bit older. You know, not at 17 or 18, they've done 1 year at college before they made the entry to the NBA.
We see swimmers do so well at such a young age. We've seen tennis players, I think back to Boris Becker winning Wimbledon, of course, at the age of, what, 17?
17, the Wunderkind, as they called him back then.
Goodness, winning Wimbledon at the age of 17. But when you think that LeBron James was a 17, 18-year-old kid and he misses out college to go from high school to become one of the, you know, walking into becoming a superstar of NBA, it just, I guess, underlines what an absolute special talent he is.
Yeah, he is, Chris, and no doubt about it. Ultimately, one of the greatest players that has ever played the game. But I think it's a good thing that they first need to go to college. I think it gives them good grounding, good understanding of life. And surely I find that the guys that have gone to college after their professional careers, they always seem to be a little bit more at ease with life than a lot of the guys that didn't go. So I think it gives you a good grounding. I think it's a fantastic rule that that they brought in, because often what happens is these high school kids become multimillionaires overnight. They're not quite able to handle their finances, not quite able to handle that celebrity life, you want to call it as such, and often go off the rails.
One other text coming in, a lot of you having your say, keep them coming on 4001, just talking about wonder kids, and it links nicely in with this text, no name on this one. Can we please talk about whether it is wise for Ross Barkley to move to either Arsenal or Spurs? Scousers normally do not do well in London, says one texter. Number 865, no name on that one. Ross Barkley, a little bit of a wonder kid. A lot was expected of him at Everton's academy when he made his breakthrough, of course, very much anointed as the next Wayne Rooney. Not quite worked out for him. Would you, you're a man that's advised sportsmen and women back in your day, Mark Archer, would you advise Ross Barkley to look for a new challenge and head for the bright lights of London?
I think he said he wants a new challenge, and I guess he wants to make that move soon. How old Ross Barkley now? 22, 23?
23, I think he is. Let me double check that.
I've got a feeling he's 23. Now, he's played for Everton since he was a kid. He said he's got 1 year left of his contract. Ronald Koeman says
23.
He's been offered a new contract at a rumoured £100,000 a week. He's turned it down. So obviously Everton want to cash in on him. They don't want him to go in a free in a year's time. But where will he go? I mean, where do you think his location will be? Arsenal was probably somewhere where you could see his skills and style of play fitting quite nicely, but also you could also see him at Spurs. So just where do you think Barkley will end up? But I think if he wants a challenge, then he needs to move on. Maybe he hasn't quite kicked on to the levels we thought he would.
I think he'll be Spurs' big summer signing. I really do. I think he is someone who, if I was an England fan, and I'm most certainly not an England national football team fan, but I would look at a Spurs, a perfect environment for Ross Barkley, because I do find sometimes he gets lost in matches. There's no real consistency in his performance. He can have one worldie one week and then go quiet for the next month. And I think Mauricio Pochettino is the perfect manager, as we've proven with Dele Alli, with Harry Kane, with who else young Eric Dyer's come through. Danny Rose has kicked on immeasurably in the last couple of years. I just think the environment with which Mauricio Pochettino has created at Spurs, I think could be perfect for Ross Barkley. But of course, it comes down to him. He's got to be the one that really fancies it, that wants to improve, that wants to kick his game on to the next level. Because, and ultimately, it doesn't matter what manager you've got, unless you want to do it yourself, then Ross Barkley will always fall into that category of what might have been.
Yeah, but Chris, I think at the end of the day, it's often the environment that you're in, and maybe he needs to change the environment. It seems like Pochettino really has got the guys firing on all cylinders, if you want to put it as such. He seems to have a very, very good team environment, and it often seems the players in that Spurs team are actually playing above themselves. And as you say, maybe this is what Ross needs. He needs that environment, a bit of new coaching, and as you say, could spark him to the promise that he's shown from a very young player.
Chris, the good thing about Barkley going to Spurs is he'll have Champions League football, so he'll get a much more experience in Europe doing that. I'm guessing the thing holding us back is that Spurs don't want to pay the rumoured £50 million for him, and as we get closer to the window closing, that price will probably come down unless another bidder comes in, because let's be fair, he's a £25 to £30 million player at best.
Yeah. And Everton, with the money that they've spent this summer, they need to start recouping some of that. So they've set the bar high. And I am led to believe that Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester United all monitoring the situation, because it may well depend if their top targets come and go, then they may have to turn their attentions to Ross Barkley. But watch this space on that one. Ultimately, though, I do think that Spurs would be a good fit for Ross Barkley. It's a great environment there. It's a team that is going places. And, of course, Ross Barkley, a 23-year-old boy, someone who is still learning the game himself. I think Mauricio Pochettino would be perfect for him. A lot more texts coming in. We're going to get to them when we come back. We're going to go round the houses as well, give you updates on all the live sport. We're building up to that second semi-final, just over an hour's time. It will be the Lions against the Hurricanes down in South Africa. All of that to come and much more between now and 6 o'clock.
Unbelievable goal!
It's a homecoming. The Grill is back at Barasti, the best bar to watch sport live every Saturday afternoon from Barasti.
Yeah, welcome back to the show up on the big screen down here at Barasti. Just kicked off between Chelsea and Inter Milan. This one over in Asia, the final pre-season friendly for Chelsea before they head back to UK. And just as I say that, Inter Milan clean through on goal. They've broken the offside trap. What a great save that is from Thibaut Courtois to keep Inter Milan out. What a good game this is already shaping up to be. 2 minutes in, but Inter should really be ahead. Interesting team news from Chelsea. I can tell you Alvaro Morata starts, the new boy from Real Madrid, Chelsea's all-time record signing and the most expensive Spaniard, of course, of all time. He starts up front alongside Michy Batshuayi, the Belgian. He is alongside the Spaniard. So goal updates on that throughout. Before we go anywhere, though, because we talked about England and debut of Toby Rowland-Jones, be remiss of us not to just dwell a little bit on India's emphatic win over in goal. Shikhar Dhawan very much the hero alongside Pujara in the first innings. Virat Kohli out for three, Mark Archer. But Virat Kohli is a dangerous animal once scalded, and he's come back, and he's come back in style.
Yeah, big win for India, 304 runs. They wrapped it up earlier today. They dismissed Sri Lanka in their second innings for 245. Jadeja and Ashwin, the Indian spinners, doing the damage. 3 for 71 for Jadeja. Ravi Ashwin with 3 for 65. But the victory was really set up on that massive innings of 600 in the first innings of India with, you said, Shikhar Dhawan on 100. He scored 190 off only 168 deliveries. That's right up there. If he got to the double 100, that would have been right up there with the fastest double 100s of all time. Of course, Nathan Astle, the fastest double 100 in history.
How many balls?
Oh, I think it was around 100. I think it was around 150, 140 to 150 at Lancaster Park. No, well, Nathan Ashton, former teammate of mine. So that was way back in 2003.
Former teammate of mine. At what level? A schoolboy under 10?
No. Representative cricket. And Chetishwar Pujara with 153.
Also a teammate of yours in 2005.
Who's that? So, yeah, a massive, massive first innings of 600 to India there. And then, of course, their bowlers really coming to the party. And then we saw Virat Kohli, when they needed to kick on and score quick runs in the second inning so they could get a declaration, Virat Kohli, the captain, steps up, 103 not out, 240 for three, sets up the declaration, and then the spinners have come into play and dismissed Sri Lanka for 245. So a very complete performance for India, obviously in the Sri Lankan conditions. Sri Lankan team will be asking some questions because obviously when India have scored 600 in the first innings, the pitch has got to be relatively good. It's not a bad batting pitch, but the Sri Lanka have only scoring two scores, 291 and 245. They'll be asking questions about their batting lineup. They haven't showed the application. They haven't been able to grind out big scores to get into the game at all, but well played India. Big win on day four. They've won the first test match by 304 runs. Big win against Sri Lanka.
Any weaknesses do you see in that Indian team? Because when I look at it, there doesn't seem to be much. Certainly in subcontinent conditions, they make hay with the bat. They've got expert spinners in Jadeja and Ashwin. It appears to me as they're a country mile ahead of anyone when it comes to playing in, I guess, conditions that very much suit their style.
Yeah, I guess the big unknown there, we're talking India don't play Pakistan enough in subcontinent conditions, which is a massive shame because Pakistan have performed very well, particularly playing their home matches in the UAE, and that's a series that hasn't really taken place in the last decade at all. India taking on Pakistan in Test cricket would be a sight to behold, but that hasn't happened, so we can only dwell on how good India are playing in Sri Lanka. And they've got the spinners, they've got the batsmen who can get the big scores, and then when you've got Ravi Ashwin, when you've got Ravindra Jadeja, Jadeja got 3 wickets in the first innings, 3 wickets in the second innings, you've got left arm spin, you've got right arm off spin, left arm off spin, you've kind of got all the bases covered there. The seamers do their job, they put a bit of pressure on with a new ball, but the spinners have really come to the fore. And when you bat first and score 600, you're not going to lose too many test matches. All the pressure goes on the home team, and Sri Lanka haven't really responded to the pressure at all.
An emphatic win that for India. The second test, where's the second test taking it? It'll be somewhere, we'll find out for you. Mark Archer's looking at me going, I'm not quite sure where that second test is. We'll keep you up to date on that one. In terms of the other live sport keeping you up to date with today, there's golf both in the US and in Europe, but I guess the major focus for us over the course of this afternoon will be the Hungarian Grand Prix qualifying today. We talked about it on the show on Thursday, Carl. Formula E is becoming, well, it's getting ever closer in the rear view mirror, it appears, of F1, but for the time being at least, all the excitement, all eyes will be on Hungary for this weekend because it's the last race before the boys head off in their summer halls.
Yeah, absolutely, and what a season it's been, Chris. I think it's the season F1 has been needing for a long, long time. Of course, it's Vettel up against Hamilton and they going head-to-head every single race. It's making it very, very exciting. Of course, Lewis Hamilton looking to equal that fantastic record set by Michael Schumacher. 68th pole position Lewis Hamilton is looking to equal today in the Hungarian Grand Prix. As I said, qualifying will start a little bit later. The big news is there that Felipe Massa has withdrawn and he's been replaced there by Paul de Resta in the Williams team. But as I say, an Hungarian circuit that Lewis Hamilton has done very well in the past. And what I can tell you is the session Q1 for qualifying will be starting, as I say, shortly. I'll be keeping you bang up to date with that. Of course, you've got Räikkönen as well as Vettel, which will go out in the Ferraris. And as I say, we'll be interested to see who ends in the front row of the grid.
We spoke to Damien Reid, F1 correspondent, and a man that knows basically everything there is to know in the world of motorsport on Thursday night, Mark Archer. There's been a lot of talk this past week of Formula E and whether it can really one day rival F1. I think this comes on the back of announcements, three major announcements this past week. First being that Britain and France are set to scrap petrol and diesel cars from 2040, which I think has got a big bearing on what we're going to witness over the course of the next 20, 30 years' time, not only on the roads, everyday roads, but certainly from an entertainment perspective. Two big announcements, two massive manufacturers, two arguably of the biggest in the world, both Mercedes and Porsche confirming that they are to back away from other sporting entities, other motorsport entities, to invest heavily and to get involved in Formula E moving forward. Thoughts?
I guess whether we like it or not, electric cars are here to stay and they're going to come quite quickly, aren't they? So at some stage in different motorsports, different forms of motorsports, are going to go electric. I think it's just the way of the world. We've seen, you know, moving outside the world of sports, Tesla become a big name player, and I guess there's more now. People are paying more attention to the electric car setup, right?
Environment, right?
Environment, exactly. So I think that, you know, Formula E has grown very quickly, very rapidly. I've got to admit, I don't follow it yet. I don't know who the big players are, but I'm guessing the growth rate of seeing manufacturers now with those news in Great Britain and in France that are starting to look to the future. And if they say the future is electric, then the future of motorsport eventually is going to move in that direction. Maybe not now, maybe not in the next decade, but eventually it's going to be a lot more resources are going to be put into electric cars, which again, in turn, the motorsport way will shift. It just has to be a natural shift at some time.
I'm a bit of a cynic in all of this, Carl. We spoke about this both on and off air on Thursday night. Part of me thinks that it looks good for PR in many respects. It looks good to sell a headline, to sell a story, to look good to consumers, perhaps look good to shareholders, to say, you know, we're actually invested both from a financial perspective, an effort perspective in Formula E long term. But are they really? Do you feel? Because, I mean, you look at some of the manufacturers that are signed up for this series. You've got Porsche now joining Mercedes, you've got Audi, you've got Jaguar. I mean, we're not talking small fry here. Renault, throw them into the mix as well. BMW, who of course we don't see in F1. They are some of the biggest manufacturers in the business.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. And, you know, I'm kind of sitting on the wire with this one because I tend to agree with you. It could be part of a PR stunt to be seen as doing the right thing, you know, supporting the environment. But coming back to what Archer says, I think, you know, it's inevitable that people are looking at electric cars, and of course electric cars are the way of the future. But to me, the big thing is, I just don't know, to me F1 is all about the smell of petrol fumes, the noise of the engines, and that all really adds to the atmosphere. And I don't really know if electric car racing will bring that. Of course, they've started the races in the inner cities. I think they've had one in Hong Kong where they race in the inner cities of the street, trying to make it exciting.
And this weekend's the season finale this year as well, over in Montreal, I think it is.
Yeah, they've got DJs playing music during the race and so forth. But I don't really know if it's got that grunt of Formula One. But I guess it's like anything in life, we will get used to it.
Yes.
The one thing that does tell me that it's definitely going that way is Bernie Ecclestone, of course, Mr. F1, he's apparently heavily invested in Formula E, which clearly tells me that it will be going that way, because Bernie never makes a mistake when it comes to investments in motor business.
He certainly does not. I guess one of the other kind of fallouts from all of this in terms of Formula E and manufacturers' apparent committal to moving forward with this series is that in the case of both Porsche and Audi pulling out from World Endurance Racing, which means Porsche and Audi, huge names in Le Mans 24 Hours, they will be no longer, and that then raises a question marks about the health of that particular race move forward. And it's world famous. It's one, of course, of the Triple Crown events.
It definitely will start affecting that type of motor racing, because all of a sudden you don't have the big players, and you know what it's like. If you don't have the big players in any tournament, you don't draw the crowds. The people don't value the event as much as what they did before. So I definitely think it will be having an impact on those traditional races.
I think the big thing to look out for with Formula E, which will be a big flag falling at some stage, is when we see several or one of the big Formula One manufacturers make the move. And they might do dual circuits or find ways of doing that. But when we see a Mercedes, when we see a McLaren, when we see a Ferrari
pull out of F1, you mean?
Pull out or start to put a team in.
Well, Mercedes is about to do that, 2019.
About to do both. Or when we see them take their team from Formula One and move it to Formula E, then I guess the manufacturers are really taking it seriously. That's the time to really probably sit up and pay attention.
I honestly tend to agree with him, but I think the big one there is Ferrari. I think if Ferrari make the move to Formula E, I think Formula One might be all over.
Yeah, Liberty Media Group, I don't envy them over the course of the next year or two, because for them, they've got to keep stakeholders happy. They've got to get more fans back on site. And I do agree with you, Carl. I think this year, in terms of what we've seen on the tracks across Europe and across the globe thus far in the 2017 season, it has breathed a bit of new life into F1, given the fact that it's not a manufactured fight for the title between Hamilton and Rosberg. I think there was an element of manufacturing that in order to put bums on seats and to sell the narrative. I think now we genuinely have two competitors, two constructors capable of winning the World Championship. And of course, we've got two wonderful World Champions in the shape of Sebastian Vettel and Lewis Hamilton duking it out for supremacy come the end of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, F1 has always been about the rivalries. You know, we can go as far as Senna and Prost. I mean, what a fantastic rivalry that was back in the days. And that's what Formula One has been looking for a long, long time. And I think finally, Ferrari have come to the party this year. They've got a very, very competitive car. We know what Sebastian Vettel can do. Of course, Vettel was faster than Lewis Hamilton in the practice session a little bit early on in Hungary. And I think this is all adding to what we enjoy to call Formula One and love to watch, Chris.
4001, let us know if you watch Formula E. I'd be very interested to talk to one of you if you do follow it very closely. I've got to be honest and transparent and say that I've seen bits. I haven't really followed it very closely because I think it is very much in the shadow of F1.
The other thing that we just raised regarding the manufacturers, I guess we can probably say the same about if any real high-profile driver switch.
Yeah.
I guess that's the things that will make us, you know, sit up and take notice if one of the two or three big teams either start competing or pull out of Formula 1, or if we see some of these high-profile drivers, albeit from Formula 1 or we see them from, you know, NASCAR or Indy, making the switch into Formula E. So I guess that would be the two big sort of moving points for me to take more notice of Formula E.
Yeah, I guess it's taking some lessons from what we see in the world of football, the Chinese Super League. We've seen an awful lot of big names head over there to try and bring a little bit more exposure. We saw the MLS do that, and I'm thinking back to the Pele days where he signed for Cosmos, Franz Beckenbauer. It's a way of getting eyeballs. It's a way of grabbing people's attention. We watched this space on that one. But 4001, are you a fan of motorsport? Do you follow Formula E? If you do, do you think that it could, in the not-too-distant future, rival F1 for eyeballs and for the dollar signs as well? Keep your thoughts coming in. We're going to get a promised double text from Mimo. Mimo, we're going to get to your text when we come back.
Unbelievable goal!
It's a homecoming. The Grill is back at Barasti. The best bar to watch sport live every Saturday afternoon from Barasti.
Really enjoying the big game on the big screen down here at Barasti. Of course, 20 screens dotted around the venue, catering for every sporting need. The big game that we're watching, though, it is a pre-season football friendly. I am the boss down here. I've ensured that the football is on. Don't you worry, though, Carl. We will ensure that Super Rugby goes on at 4:30, the second at semi-final. Mark Archer nodding at that as well. I've been outnumbered. One South African, one Kiwi, which means the rugby will go on. But we're enjoying at the moment. It's Chelsea against Inter Milan. It's in Singapore, Carl?
Yeah, the game's happening in Singapore, Chris. And I must say, a very, very good crowd. Seems to be that the Milan team is supported a little bit more than Chelsea. But so far, two great attacks. Chelsea looking pretty sharp at this moment in time. And, yeah, that seems like they're getting everything nice and gelled before the Premier League starts in 2 weeks' time, as you said.
Yeah, I'm interested to watch this developing partnership between Michy Batshuayi, the Belgian, and Alvaro Morata. It looks as if they're just swapping, interchanging positions. Alvaro Morata currently occupying the wide left position, Batshuayi through the middle. Some of his moves thus far, some of his little runs in behind the Inter defence. I am, of course, talking about Batshuayi here. Very, very impressive. I know he's already scored a couple of goals against Arsenal in pre-season, but watch this space with Batshuayi. There has been some suggestion that doesn't see eye to eye with Antonio Conte, or certainly that Conte wasn't really fancying the young Belgian after his big money move from Marseille last summer. But in the early suggestions, the early signs in this pre-season is that Batshuayi is up for the fight and could well emerge as an integral part of Conte's squad this season moving forward. 90 minutes gone. It is Chelsea 0, Inter Milan 0. Want to return to the text messages if we can for just a second, because Mimo has messaged a couple of times this afternoon. Thank you very much, Mimo, for your text. He says, keep good eye on Liverpool duo Mohamed Salah and Sadio Mane this season. I think they will be ripping defences apart. Mimo, you're telling us nothing new. We've been talking about this the past couple of weeks. I think Jurgen Klopp certainly has his favoured four, his front four of Salah, Mane, either side of Coutinho, Firmino. If he can keep those four, first and foremost, with Coutinho being linked with the move to Barcelona, but if he can keep those four and keep those four fit, I think Chelsea, Liverpool do well again this season.
Absolutely deadly. And I mean, Liverpool had a fantastic season that just passed. And the time when they caught the dip, of course, when Sadio Mane went to the African Cup of Nations, he came back a little bit injured. And obviously that January-February period, that's when they lost a lot of points. So, Chris, I fully agree. It's vital for them to keep that top four going up front, and they will definitely be a team to contend with. Saying that, though, once they get that defensive line sorted out, you know, I think this is what really, really cost them this season, because going forward, they were fantastic. But going back, there were a lot of questions asked often at times. And I think Jurgen Klopp knows that. He will come into the season a lot better prepared. Of course, a lot more experience in the Premier League now. And once again, I fully agree with the listener there. Liverpool will be a dangerous team this year.
It's the old cliche, isn't it? From what I've seen this summer and the money that's been spent and the money that I still expect to be spent, there's an awful lot of players I still think that will be swelling some of those squads. It is once again teed up to be another outstanding, intriguing, exciting, call it what you will, Premier League season, because with Everton spending the money that they have done, and again we can only judge them on paper thus far, Arch, it looks to me as if we could be looking at a big seven in any one of the seven, maybe not Everton to win the league per se, but any one of the seven or seven of those teams, those seven, will be competing for the top four.
What was interesting is most of last pre-season we were talking about not players but managers. Conte, first season, Mourinho coming to United, Pep Guardiola being in there for the first time. So it was all about the managers, and the managers were really inheriting most of the previous manager squads, barring one or two players. This season, it's not really about the managers, it's about them signing players that have now become their teams. And so that will be interesting. Again, there's a couple of big domino moves that are going to happen. Still a month left of the transfer window. And it's always funny because the season starts in 2 weeks' time. You have the first 2 weeks of the season. If one team doesn't seem to be scoring goals, it seems to have a defensive weakness, there's always a panic buy or two in the last week, particularly in the last day of the season. But it is going to be fascinating. Teams have spent a lot of money. There's a lot of pressure on for immediate results. And once those results don't start coming in, if teams don't gel, if players are coming late now, a lot of the teams are finishing up their pre-season this week. Players are going to be moving without having a pre-season with their club. They're going to move countries in some cases or examples. It's going to be quite difficult to start the season quite quickly. So that will be interesting factors. But as you say, Chris, it is fascinating. And what makes it interesting about the Premier League are there are so many teams, so many storylines with lots of money, lots of budgets. And even the teams that haven't spent money, like Spurs, did so well in the last couple of seasons without a signing. They've still kept that squad together. They haven't really lost anyone
yet. Kyle Walker's
gone. But there will be some signings at some stage, I'm sure. So very fascinating times in the Premier League. Plenty of money, plenty of big names still yet to come.
Two things that you just mentioned there, Arch. First of those, Carl, is that Arch is right to say that there are now no hiding places. There are now no excuses for your Jose Mourinho's, your Pep Guardiola's, your Antonio Conte's, who now know what English football is all about, know the Premier League, know the players that they're working with. They've now, at least in part, got the teams that they want, the squads that they want. It is, and that adds to, I guess, some of the fascination this year that there are no hiding places, which means heads may roll come the end of the season if they don't get the results.
That was going to be my question to you. If you have to name two managers that are under the biggest pressure before the start of the season, you've got to look north. You've got to look at the two managers in Manchester, because Mourinho, call it, had an excuse last season. Yes, I inherited the squad I didn't really want. He's went out now. He spent a lot of money, so he's basically got no more excuses. Pep basically could have used the same excuse. He's gone out. You see the amount of money he spent. So I reckon those two are under enormous pressure for results.
They're under pressure, yes. But again, I question whether City would sack Guardiola. He has been the man that they have built that football team in his image. They have built that football club for him. That's first and foremost
what
I'd
say. Well, I'll ask you the question then. If you're City management and City owners, what are your minimum expectations for this season? What are your minimum expectations?
With the money that they've spent and the squad that they've got?
I mean, win
the Premier League or the Champions League?
And what happens if they don't achieve either of them? Does Pep Guardiola come under pressure?
I don't think he does.
Come on.
Honestly,
come
I don't
on,
think
McCartney.
He does.
Steve Jobs got sacked by Apple, if you know what I'm saying, a company that he started. I think Pep Guardiola, if he does not produce one of those two trophies that Mark Archer mentioned this season, I think he might not be around for next season.
I think there's an awful lot of credit in the bank for Pep Guardiola. I really do. And listen, if he was
to
finish...
But not City. I mean, big money, but how long do you give him? If City win no silverware this year, when does the pressure start to be applied? Because you can't spend the money that City have done and not get results and not win things.
No, I agree. I completely agree with that. But I just think that Guardiola is Manchester City's Everest. They've reached the top.
Do you think he's untouchable?
A little, yeah. I think the only way that Guardiola becomes touchable, if that sounds even remotely that just sounds weird, but if they don't finish inside the top four, so they finish outside the top four and they win nothing, then I think you could either see Pep walk because he will feel so embarrassed with their level of performance this season, or maybe the City owners will feel that they'll feel that there's no alternative. They need to get rid of the Spaniard. But if he finishes top four again, and again, we're ifs and buts and we're looking ahead into the future, it would all depend on how close he's got to various trophies. If they're beaten in a few finals, if they finish second behind Manchester United, then there's still enough credit in the
second,
bank for me.
Second is second.
Second is second. I appreciate that, Arch, but it is very different. If he finishes
no
fourth...
No one remembers who
fourth,
finishes second.
No, I get that. But if it comes down, let's say, to a final day shootout and City, you know, I don't know, lose and they lose on goal difference, whatever the case may be, I still think Guardiola will be in charge the season after this. I really do, because I just think Manchester City were flirting with that man for so long. The football club is built to move forward. He has been given carte blanche, is my understanding. What he says goes. If he wants the walls painted purple, the walls will be painted purple.
Okay, let me move it to the red side of Manchester, Chris. Jose Mourinho, what's his minimum goals this season after the money he's spent? Still business to be done?
Premier League title. I think, whereas City, I think, would take the Champions League or the Premier League. I think if you ask Jose now, it will be a reacquainting oneself with the Champions League after being out of it a couple of the last 3 years. We're doing well, reaching the knockout stages. For Jose this season, it's about winning the Premier League once again. It's got to be about that. History shows that in his second seasons, Jose more often than not gets it right. We've seen that Inter Milan. We saw that when, of course, they went on to win the treble. We saw it as well at Porto when he went on to win the Champions League. So second seasons are very much when Jose comes into his own. Huge pressure on his shoulders. But again, Arch, United have been through a lot of managers in a short space of time. David Moyes, Louis van Gaal, now Jose. Even if he wasn't to win the Premier League this season, because he's won the Europa League, because he's won the League Cup, if he stays in the top four...
And Community Shield. Three pieces of silverware, Chris.
Don't talk about the Community Shield.
Three cups last season.
In a strange sort of way, I think they're almost two of the most secure bosses. The one man who I think, and you're looking at me strangely with that, Carl, I can tell you now, they will both still be in charge of those respective football clubs come the start of next season, if that makes sense. So 2018-19.
I don't agree with you. I believe if City don't win any silverware, Pep could be on his way back to Spain.
We'll continue this conversation because I'll tell you who I think is under most pressure, and it might surprise one or two of you. Keep your thoughts coming in on 4001. Add to the conversation as well. Do you agree with my assertion that Guardiola and Mourinho, I wouldn't say untouchable, but a little, I think there's credit in the bank? Or do you agree with Carl and Arch that, simply put, results matter, and if they don't get them, they'll be out on their ear? Keep your thoughts coming in on 4001. You're listening to The Grill, live from Barasti.
Unbelievable goal!
It's a homecoming. The Grill is back at Barasti, the best bar to watch sport live every Saturday afternoon from Barasti.